Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Listener, this week we're going to take a step back from protests, politics, pandemics and interminable alliterations. Instead, we're going to turn our attention stateside, and with the help of Haaretz's recently returned correspondent in Washington, we'll take a look back at the last 3.5 years in terms of U.S.-Israel relations and the American-Jewish experience. And we'll look ahead to November, when, despite President Trump's desire for a delay, there will be a presidential election. Welcome back to Israel, and welcome to the podcast, Amir Tibon.
Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me on.
Great to see you, and great to have you in the studio. Absolutely. Welcome change. Amir, before we switch our focus to the other side of the Atlantic, can we talk briefly about the anti-Netanyahu protests by Israeli expats across the United States? That must have been rather surreal.
Yeah, we had an article about it last week, and we're actually going to publish a follow-up story today because it's growing. When we reported about it last week, there was one demonstration in San Francisco and another one in New York, but this weekend you already have demonstrations going up in Boston, Miami, LA, Toronto in Canada, and Washington, D.C. in front of the embassy. So this is really spreading out, and you're seeing Israelis living abroad who are watching these demonstrations that are happening in Israel on their Facebook pages and reading about them at Haaretz, and they decide that they want to join. They can't sit and stand on the side and look at what's happening in Israel. And I think you're going to see hundreds of people from different Israeli expat communities in the U.S. joining this protest, and I think by next week we could maybe see 10 other cities join. It's a really interesting phenomenon, because usually Israelis who are living abroad, if they get politically active at all on issues related to Israel, it will be supporting the government, acting against BDS, going out to demonstrate against something that they perceive as anti-Semitic or anti-Israeli. And suddenly you have this phenomenon, it's really new, of Israelis going out to demonstrate against the Netanyahu government and doing it in the United States. I think it's unprecedented, and I'm really interested to see how this story will develop, if it will continue to grow, just like the demonstrations here in Israel have grown, right? Something that a few weeks ago was just a few hundred people outside of the prime minister's residence in Jerusalem is now bringing tens of thousands of people. So definitely an interesting story to keep following.
And the expats have got demo FOMO, you could say. How did the locals react, if at all?
So in San Francisco, for example, the Israelis who joined the protest told me that the local Jewish community was a bit confused by the whole situation. Because, as I said, they are used to having these situations where if you go out to demonstrate, it's to support Israel or celebrate Israel. Mm-hmm. And when you have something that you want to protest, something that you don't like, you maybe send a letter or you send a petition. This is one criticism, by the way, that I have on American Jewry and its relationship with the Israeli government, that American Jewish organizations have somehow convinced the American Jewish community that if you send a letter to Prime Minister Netanyahu saying we are very concerned, it actually is going to make a difference or somebody is going to care about it. And usually, of course, nobody is even going to read it, except, you know, we're going to report about it in Haaretz, right? But the prime minister is not going to actually read the letter.
And maybe
they are less used to the Israeli style, which is, you know, when you want to protest over something, you go out to the bridges and to the in front of the embassies or the consulates, and you shout and you sing and you bring out your protest, which is the normal thing to do. I mean, people in America are doing it as well on many other subjects. But I have heard that it's causing some confusion in the Jewish community, and I think that's good confusion. It's a good thing to deal with and to start understanding the situation here in Israel right now, where people are very upset over corruption and over the economic situation, and that's what's driving the conversation here.
Okay, Amir, so your first week in D.C. for Haaretz just happened to coincide with the inauguration of President Donald Trump, a ceremony that was marred by protests, doctored photographs, and arguments over crowd size. It even rained, right?
Yes.
Despite what Trump claimed. What was that like? Did that set the tone for the rest of your time
if
there?
Speaking about protests and demonstrations, I think the ones I covered on the weekend of Trump's inauguration, it was the Women's March and other protests against him. Those were probably the largest demonstrations that I got to see during my time in Washington. Of course, back then, we did not talk about the COVID. COVID and there were no limitations on gatherings and people went out, you know, just like that. And it was in the hundreds of thousands of people. It was a really crazy weekend to land into that situation in Washington, D.C. On the one hand, this Trump inauguration and the sense of a really new era beginning in American politics. And on the other hand, the huge crowds that were gathered. And I think we're also signaling that a new era is beginning, an era of resistance and of strong opposition and very consistent opposition to this government. And I think I would really say that that day set the tone for everything that happened up to the midterm elections to, you know, in November of 2018, you know, a year and almost 2 years by now ago. I would look at that as one stretch. What started on the day of Trump's inauguration ended on that election day.
It was a period of great divisiveness, and in a way that weekend symbolized the great divide that emerged after January 2018.
Well, I don't think you've had a situation before in American politics where the presidential inauguration is seen on television as a split-screen event. It's a split-screen between the inauguration on the one hand and on the other hand these demonstrations. And this showed that for a huge segment of American population, from day one, they looked at Trump's presidency as something that is, well, I don't want to say illegitimate, but has less of the legitimacy than previous administrations because of how what happened in the election and how the results came to be and because of how Trump himself decided to present his presidency to the American people on that same day. I mean, his inauguration speech, it was not a speech about America coming together and all the other cliches that presidents usually use on their first day in office. It was a very political and very divisive speech by itself, really setting the tone for his presidency up to this point. And yeah, I think what started on that day or that weekend in you know, the weekend of January 20th is still dictating the conversation in America, and it's going to continue doing it maybe for years. We'll see what happens in November.
And what happened in those midterms, in those 2018 midterms that for you marked a turning point?
I think the midterm elections showed that the energy that exists against Trump in the United States, it can be very, very efficient when it doesn't necessarily have to unite behind one candidate. If you look at the results of the 2016 election, Donald Trump did not win a majority of the votes, right? He won around, I think, 46%. And even in some of the most important swing states that gave him the Electoral College victory, he did not win a majority. He did not get a majority, not in Michigan, not in Wisconsin, not in Pennsylvania. But what happened is that because the anti-Trump vote was not solidified behind Hillary Clinton, but instead it was broken, right? Clinton received 49%, but then the Green Party received some votes, you know, all of these very, very pure and smart leftists who decided they just couldn't vote for Clinton, so they gave Trump the presidency by voting for the Greens. And then the Libertarians, Gary Johnson, got about 2% of the vote. And then you had people who just didn't vote at all or went to the voting booth and wrote Bernie Sanders' name, all kinds of stuff. Eventually, you know, the 52%, the majority that is anti-Trump, could not solidify, could not unite behind Clinton. In the midterm elections, you had a different situation because it's not Trump versus Clinton. It's a range of candidates on a local level in congressional districts, Senate, governor's elections, other kinds of local office holders. And all that energy suddenly actually was useful because people didn't have to unite behind one candidate and say, do I like them or not? They could vote against Trump, in a sense, in their local level and do it for many different people. And I think the main question for the anti-Trump forces in the United States, and they are clearly a majority, Trump has not had the support of a majority of Americans in one single poll since entering the White House. That's crazy. You've never had a president like that. His approval rating has never gone above 50%. So you still have that anti-Trump majority that existed from the day of 2016 election. You still have it, but will it be able this time to solidify like it, you know, like we saw in the midterms? Or will it again be broken into segments? Some will go to Biden, some will go to the Green Party, some will go to some other, you know, Kanye West is running for president and he's trying to take votes away from Biden. It's very clear. Will people stay home or do the riding stuff again? And if that happens, I think, you know, we will have another interesting inauguration day in January when Trump starts his second term.
And this, presumably, the uniting the anti-Trump front is presumably what the Democrats have got to focus on in the 90-odd days before November the 3rd,
yeah,
right?
But see, in the midterms it was easier, right? Because in the midterms what you had is candidates that are a good, or, well, if they're bad, they're lost. But if they're a good fit for their specific district or their specific state, they could unite the anti-Trump vote in the district or in the state. And that is a coalition that stretches all the way from moderate Republicans who don't like Trump, and sometimes even, I would say, conservative Republicans who don't like Trump, all the way to far left, you know, supporters of Sanders and beyond who also don't like Trump, but for very different reasons. But again, when you go to vote in that kind of election, you live in a specific district or in a state where you would have a candidate that supposedly represents, you know, can hold together the coalition. When it comes to the presidential election, you can only vote for Joe Biden if you don't want Trump to be president. I mean, you can also do all kinds of other exercises, vote for Kanye, vote for the Greens, but essentially in that kind of scenario, you are making it easier for Trump to remain president. Mm. It's much more difficult, I feel, for the Democrats today to hold together this coalition behind a one presidential candidate, especially when, you know, if Biden says something that one part of the coalition doesn't like, he loses some votes on the right. But then he has a statement that maybe people on the right will be happier with, but he loses some votes on the left. It's a very difficult coalition to maintain.
Mm. Will Biden's choice of running mate, of vice presidential candidate, will that perhaps help? Will he be looking to choose somebody who can help unite all the wings of the anti-Trump?
So first of all, we're going to have a story today you know, about the different candidates for vice president and where they stand specifically on the issue of Israel, which is important to our readers.
Of course.
But in general, I think also with the vice president, it's the same problem. You can't really have a candidate that will appeal to everyone in this broad coalition. You can't have a candidate that will satisfy the kind of, you know, moderate Republican who is defecting from the party to vote for Biden and also satisfy the Bernie Sanders voter who wants to drag the country more to the left. You don't really have an option to catch both of them together and make everyone happy. So you can either try to appeal to one of them and then maybe try to make up with the other side with another appointment, or you can try to go more for something that is just, you know, hits it for the majority of the Democratic base, which is center-left, where Biden himself is, right? I mean, he won the nomination because he really represents the opinions, I think, of a big majority of Democrats.
Right, so could he perhaps afford to choose a more, perhaps, left-field candidate, a woman of color,
That would be the dilemma, right? Because I think if he says, all right, I look at what happened to Clinton in 2016, I don't want to have these, you know, hundreds of thousands of left-wing voters put a vote in for the Green Party or write in Bernie Sanders. I want them to vote for me, and I want that to be the winning margin. He takes maybe somebody from the left, but then again, he could lose some support on the right. And he does seem to attract, at least right now in polling, moderate Republicans. And again, if you look at the midterm elections as your kind of compass for the Democratic success, and they had a big success in November 2018, they did it in a lot of districts where you needed the votes of moderate Republicans in order to win. And they still need those votes in order not just to get Biden to the White House, but also to keep their majority in Congress and maybe to win some Senate seats. Mm. I mean, the Senate seats that are up for grabs this year, they're not in New York or in Vermont or in California. Mm-hmm. They are in states where, in order to win, the Democrats need to bring together the entire coalition from the left all the way to the moderate right, you know, Arizona, North Carolina, Iowa, Montana. In Montana, it's even harder. You know, you have a governor, Steve Bullock, a Democrat, who's running for Senate, and he cannot win without attracting Trump voters to vote for him. So I think it's going to be a really interesting balancing act. And I think the one thing the Democrats are counting on is that Trump will remain the glue that makes this coalition stick together. Mm. That at the end of the day, every time Trump is in the news for saying something divisive, for making a comment about Russia that infuriates people, for promoting some kind of legislation that is unpopular with the general public, that this is what will hold the coalition together. But if the focus would be more and more on Biden and who did he choose for VP and who didn't he choose for VP, that actually, I think, weakens the coalition.
Maybe that's why he's taking so long to make up his decision.
Probably,
yeah.
Yes.
The one place that Trump would probably win a resounding majority is right here in Israel, right? I mean, a recent poll found that 56% of Israelis would prefer a second Trump administration over Joe Biden. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. Maybe it surprises me that the number is a little low. Maybe, I don't know, maybe people's perception of Trump in Israel changed over time, because I think a year ago it would have been 70%. This is something I often had to explain when I was in the U.S. and I used to have these speaking engagements with Jewish communities and synagogues, and they would ask me, how can the Israelis like Trump so much, especially when you see how much he's really hated in the American Jewish community? So first of all, I think there is general genuine support and admiration for him in the Israeli right wing, which is a big component of the Israeli politics and society. Religious people in Israel, I think, like him very much. I think when it comes to the Israeli center and even some parts of the left, it's not as great of a support as you would see on the right, but still there is appreciation for some of the policies that he did regarding Israel. That doesn't mean necessarily that Israelis would like to have Trump as their leader on every policy issue. If Trump tried to do on healthcare here in Israel what he failed to do in America, people would be revolting in the streets, because in Israel we have universal health care. Everybody's covered, every citizen. And in America, he tried to cancel Obamacare, which is, you know, it's not universal, but it's the closest America has gotten to that kind of coverage. That would not fly, even with right-wing voters in Israel. They would not want to cancel, you know, the Kupat Cholim, the kind of health care that we have here in Israel. I also think some of the policies that Trump advanced on environmental issues, even that would not really work out very well in Israel. He wants now to open some of the national parks for, mining uranium and things like that.
Including Yosemite.
Yeah, Yosemite Park. Yeah. But I think most Israelis, at the end of the day, when they look at Trump, they examine him through the lens of his policy on Israel. And on that specific issue, they tend to like what they see. Of course, my personal view is the opposite. I think that it's his policy on Israel that has been one of the most problematic aspects of his presidency. But that's a personal opinion now, and I think most people here don't agree with my view on it.
Well, Netanyahu certainly doesn't. He's called Trump the greatest friend Israel has ever had in the White House, and their alliance is rock solid. But
yes,
it hasn't always been plain sailing, right? There have been hiccups along the way.
It's interesting. During the first year of the Trump presidency, I think Netanyahu was much more concerned, because it did seem at times that Trump could be serious about getting an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal. And of course, if you're serious about an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal, you need both sides to make concessions. And making concessions for Netanyahu would mean the end of his rule, because what is holding Netanyahu in power right now is the loyalty of the right wing, and specifically the religious right wing in Israel. And of course, a lot of these people have bought into Netanyahu's arguments against the legal system and against the media and against the courts. But at the end of the day, they stick with him because they see him as someone who delivers on the issues that are important to them. There is no Palestinian state. The settlements are expanding. The Palestinian issue is resonating less and less in the international arena. And this is the real basis of Netanyahu's support. If you had Donald Trump, with all of his popularity in Israel, advancing some kind of a serious peace plan that would require Israel to take down settlements, to evacuate territories, Netanyahu would be lost at sea. He could not go out against Trump, because who's the alternative? You know, the Democratic Party. But also, if you would go along, the right wing would basically lose interest in him. And I think for the first year of the Trump presidency, Netanyahu was really concerned about it, because we didn't know for sure what Trump was planning to do. And I want to remind you that in the first year of the Trump presidency, there were some serious people working next to Trump, people who actually were serious about policy and had more sound judgment. You know, James Mattis, the former general who was the defense secretary, H.R. McMaster, another general who was the national security advisor, Rex Tillerson, who was the secretary of state, and they were advocating for a much more reasonable Middle East policy. And they told Trump, for example, not to move the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, because they said this would not help you get a peace deal. Trump kept talking about how much he wants to get this deal. He called it the ultimate deal and said that it's the hardest one to get, and kept saying that, you know, if he can't do it, then nobody can do it. He has the ability because of his business background, etc. And I think he really wanted that deal, and he wanted the Nobel Prize that would come along with it. And they kept telling him, Mr. President, if you move the embassy to Jerusalem, you're not getting it. If you decide to adopt all of the arguments of Netanyahu and the settler movement in Israel, you're not getting it. And he did listen for a while. In June of 2017, half a year into his presidency, Trump, everybody forgets it now, Trump signed a piece of paper that basically says he is delaying the moving of the American embassy in Israel by half a year because, you know, you have a law in America that Congress passed in the 1990s that you have to move the embassy, and all the presidents ever since, Republicans and Democrats, have kept delaying and delaying. And Trump, in June 17, joined the party, joined the group of the presidents who delayed. And after that, I think something changed. He began to feel pressure from evangelical pastors and leaders who supported him, and maybe from Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate, who was his biggest donor in the election. And they convinced him to take a much more right-wing approach that is in tune with the settler movement in Israel. And we started seeing that by the end of 2017 with the announcement of the embassy move. And then into 2018, you know, basically his entire policy ever since has been geared at that demographic, you know, pleasing the evangelical voters, making the religious right wing in Israel happy. And as a result, nobody is seriously talking anymore about his peace plan. It's become a total joke. The only question now is, will Israel annex settlements unilaterally or not? Nobody is even talking about negotiations, a peace deal. And I think this will be remembered as one of the tragedies of the Trump administration eventually, because I think Donald Trump, whether he wins a second term or not, had the best potential to bring a deal of any president in the I would say since Bill Clinton went to Camp David 20 years ago. I think because of his popularity in Israel, because of the fact that he's actually appreciated by some of the thugs ruling the area around us, some of the dictators and the kings in the other countries around us, and because Netanyahu could not actually politically survive standing up to him, I think he had great cards to play with, and he could have actually made progress on this issue, but he chose to listen to people who didn't want to make progress on this issue and to go with a very extreme policy that led him to nowhere. And, you know, this deal is now off the table.
It seems like his response was more opportunistic than anything else.
Yeah, and driven by politics.
He did whatever he needed to do at that moment to please his base, to please Sheldon, and to please Netanyahu.
It's also an interesting question. What would have happened if Trump would have gone along with a serious peace plan? Would he actually lose evangelical support? I've written a lot about the evangelicals during my 3 years in Washington. I don't have a yes or no answer for this, because evangelicals at the same time like other things that Trump did. You know, he appointed Supreme Court justices who are conservative, although now there is some anger with Gorsuch, one of his appointments. But still, you know, he gave them a lot of conservative judges. He did all kinds of executive orders on religious issues that were meant to please this crowd.
And energy legislation and so on.
Yes, and immigration. So it's not like Israel is a single issue. But I think he bought into the argument that if he does anything that would make Netanyahu unhappy, he would lose evangelical support. And that's the policy that we've been seeing in the last 3 years.
We get the impression here that the Trump-Netanyahu alliance is purely one of quid pro quo. As both of them are likely to be facing an election in the coming months. Trump, for sure, BB
he's
quite possibly.
He's trying to cancel it, but he's not going to be able
exactly.
to.
Exactly. Yeah. Will we see them help each other out in terms of electioneering?
This is a great question.
And what can Bibi do to help Trump? And what can Trump do to help Bibi?
I think now it's Netanyahu's time. Because in the last three elections that we had in Israel, Trump came for Netanyahu big time. Okay, it started with the Golan recognition in the election of April 2019. In March, you know, 2 weeks before the election, suddenly Netanyahu comes to Washington and they sign this map that recognizes the Golan as part of Israel and make a big ceremony. In the second election, 3 days before the election in September of 2019, Trump announces that he spoke with Netanyahu over the phone and they discussed a mutual defense treaty for the two countries. Of course, after the election, nobody spoke about that anymore. It disappeared, but it was timed to help Netanyahu in the election. Mm-hmm. And then in the third election, they unveiled the whole peace plan and they had a big ceremony at the White House with Netanyahu on the stage. And they did it on the same day that Netanyahu was formally indicted for bribery and fraud and breach of trust.
Well, that's the point. Surely both men's troubles are so deep and so pervasive that no gesture by either party will be enough to make a difference.
Well, that's a good question. But for sure, I think it's now Netanyahu's time to pay back because Trump helped him immensely. Three times. I think, honestly, Trump has run out of moves. I mean, annexation is the only thing he can still do to help Netanyahu. Mm. And I'm not sure it helps in the current atmosphere in Israel because people here in Israel are not focused on the Palestinian issue right now or on the settlements. People are worried about the state of the economy. They're worried about the pandemic, about the health system. People are not so focused about this issue of the settlements. And I'm not sure this is what will make a big difference for Bibi. For Trump, it could make a difference maybe if Netanyahu came forward and explicitly said this is the greatest president we ever had and he's such a friend and almost endorsed him. But there is also a big risk for Netanyahu to do that kind of move because at the end of the day, if Trump loses the election and you have Joe Biden in the White House, he will be vindictive. He will remember such a gesture. Joe Biden doesn't hate Bibi Netanyahu.
Yet.
He really doesn't. They worked together for many years, ever since Biden was a young senator in the Foreign Relations Committee. Mm. When Obama was president and Biden was VP, many times Biden was actually the person that Obama used to try and diffuse tensions with Israel and with Netanyahu. Because of the history, because of the friendship that they had. I don't think Biden is going to go into the White House with some kind of bull's eye transfixed on Netanyahu. But if Netanyahu will actively campaign for Trump and help Trump against Biden, he will turn a friend into an enemy. Mm. So that, there is a big risk there as well.
Amir, so you were on the ground for two of the most traumatic and perhaps symbolic events of the Trump administration so far, Charlottesville and Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes, when I came to Washington to do this job for Aretz, I expected to use my experience as a reporter covering politics and foreign policy and diplomacy. Mm. I didn't think I would have to use my experience as a reporter covering terror attacks. Mm. But this is what happened. We had two terrible anti-Semitic, far-right attacks. In Charlottesville, the march where people went in the streets and shouted, "Jews will not replace me." And in Pittsburgh, this evil person who went into a synagogue on Shabbat morning and just shot and murdered innocent people who were praying. And for both events, I was sent by Aretz immediately to cover it on the ground. Both of them, by the way, happened in the most uncomfortable personal circumstances. Charlottesville, it happened after my wife and I were basically kind of separated for a few months. I was already in Washington working for Aretz. She was in Israel. She had to finish her master's degree and finish something at her work. And the weekend, she finally joined me in the United States, not for a visit, not for a week, but actually moved to America, was the weekend of Charlottesville. And I told the newspaper at the time, I need maybe a day or two off. My wife is coming from Israel. Mm-hmm. He said, no problem. You know, I have good bosses here at Aretz. And then this thing happens, you know. And first of all, for me, I have to immediately drive down there because is a once in a decade kind of event. But I also think from her perspective, she just landed in this country. And the first thing she turns on the television, she sees these neo-Nazis marching in the streets saying, "Jews will not replace me.
Welcome to America."
I felt bad for her. And Pittsburgh was even worse because Pittsburgh was the weekend of my brother's wedding. My young brother, which I'm very proud of. He's a doctor working here in Israel, and he was spent time in the COVID department during the current wave. But he married an American Jewish girl who made Aliyah to Israel. And they live in Jerusalem, but her family is still in Boston. And they decided to do two wedding events, one in Israel and one in America. And the event in America, in Boston, the wedding over there, was the same weekend of the Pittsburgh shooting.
Oh, my goodness.
So Saturday morning, we get ready to go to one of the events. Because, you know, Jewish Americans' weddings, it's a bit different than the Israelis. It's more of like a weekend event.
Right.
It's not just one and done. So we are getting ready to go to one of the wedding events. Everybody's happy. And suddenly I turn on the television and I see these breaking first reports about a shooting at a synagogue. I immediately knew I'm going to have to drop everything. Yeah. I flew to Pittsburgh. I was there, I think, two or three. I got on the first flight. 2 or 3 hours later, I was already there on the ground. The next day, I flew back in the evening to attend the wedding on Sunday night. And then Monday morning, I flew back to Pittsburgh. It was kind of a crazy weekend.
Wow. Listen, every time that we mention, you know, the Tree of Life shooting, we state it was the worst anti-Semitic attack on American soil. Has the aftermath been as profound as the attack itself, the immediate responses to it?
You know, I came back to Pittsburgh a year later as well to do a one-year two kind of series of stories, several articles about it. And I feel that it really did change the Jewish community in several profound ways, some of them bad, some of them good. One of the most obvious impacts is the issue of security.
Right.
Because before the synagogue shooting in Tree of Life, it was rare to see security outside an American synagogue. Some communities had it, but in most of America, you go into a synagogue on Saturday night, there is maybe some person unarmed standing outside to greet people. Maybe there's a camera transfixed on the building, but you didn't have the level of security that you have today. I think in every synagogue that you go into, you would have today some kind of, you know, either a more robust security system, or on Shabbat morning, actually an armed guard or a policeman or a police car that is parked outside. And I saw that everywhere around me after the Pittsburgh shooting. I saw it in the communities around where I lived, but also in places that I traveled to report from. Mm. Another interesting change that I think in Pittsburgh, that conversation started after Tree of Life. And I think today, because of COVID, it's happening in many other communities as well. There were discussions about maybe having less Jewish institutions, basically by uniting the existing ones and creating larger institutions out of combinations. In Pittsburgh, this began because of the security issue, because the need to invest money in security for so many synagogues. If you look at the Squirrel Hill neighborhood, this is the beautiful, romantic, you know, just wonderful neighborhood in Pittsburgh where the shooting took place. You have about 10 synagogues there in a very small neighborhood. And people began having these discussions. Do we really need each and every one of these institutions now to have an armed guard outside? And how can they afford it without going bankrupt? And one rabbi in Pittsburgh actually told me, if somebody came up with an evil plan to defund the Jewish community, to make them go bankrupt, this would be the plan. Just get everyone to hire armed guards. And they began to have these discussions about uniting synagogues, uniting other kinds of Jewish institutions, schools and JCCs and whatnot. Today, that conversation is actually happening everywhere in America, because I think between COVID, which is, you know, creating a lot of problems with the finance and
of course,
and then the security needs that still exist, because some crazy person can still go and attack a synagogue even when you have a pandemic, this is causing people to have more and more of this kind of discussion.
So maybe, you know, it will unite across the denominations and across the streams, the reform and the conservative and the orthodox.
The most radical version is what we heard, I think, from Rick Jacobs of the reform movement, president of URJ, who talked about actually bringing together the movements, you know, conservative and reform Judaism. But I think on the local level, it starts just with, you know, do we need to have three synagogues in a city of so-and-so people? Or can we maybe have two? In this neighborhood, do we really need to have a conservative and a reform shul? Or can we have, like in Charlottesville, for example, there is a beautiful synagogue in downtown Charlottesville that was also attacked at the time by the neo-Nazi marchers. And there was a local resident who was a Navy SEAL who came to protect the synagogue, stood outside while people were praying. Right. A very, very touching story. But that synagogue, they already have that kind of arrangement where they have a conservative prayer on, I don't remember if it's on Friday night, and then reform on or Saturday morning, or the other way around. But I think it's beautiful, and people choose. Some people go to both. Some people go only to one. Some people alternate. So these kinds of solutions, I think, are going to have to become a bigger part of the discussion just because of the needs of the times that we live in.
Maybe we'll move on from the old joke about the Jewish guy who gets
it's
stranded
about time,
on,
right?
A,
I mean, that joke,
on a desert island and builds two synagogues.
Can't hear that joke anymore. It's about time to move on.
Absolutely. So listen, Emil, the last 6 months of your time in Washington were also pretty dramatic. Some would say life-changing.
Yes.
And I'm referring, of course, to the birth of your daughter, Mazal Tov. She's what? She's 4 months old
right now?
I can't imagine how it feels becoming a parent during a global pandemic, especially living in a country where the response to that pandemic is being managed by Donald Trump.
I did.
I don't live there. I can say that. So, listen, there have been various reports about how the coronavirus pandemic has hit Jewish communities particularly hard. One comprehensive report that I read stated stated that rates of infection and mortality amongst Jews are significantly higher, sometimes even several times higher, than among the general population, and that from the very beginning, the pandemic has presented a major challenge to leaders and rabbis of Jewish communities around the world.
Yep.
Now, we know that obviously there's no such thing as American Jews. They're far too diverse and broad for that label. But how have Jewish communities responded to the pandemic?
So that is such a big, big question. But I would say, first of all, the hardest hit, of course, have been the ultra-Orthodox communities in the New York area. They took a terrible beating from this virus. And we're talking about hundreds of people who died and entire communities that were shut down for a very long period. And this is also a story that had impact in Israel, because some people from those communities then came to Israel, and that became a whole controversy of itself. But they were the hardest hit, and we had great reporting in Haaretz at the time by Daniel Ziri, our correspondent in New York, who did, I think, fantastic job covering the suffering and the confusion and the fear in those ultra-Orthodox communities
around
New York.
Right, we also had similar reports from the United Kingdom and from France.
Yep. With regards to the broader Jewish community, it's been less of an issue of the health impacts of the virus, which are a big concern for everyone. But I don't think that you can say that a Reform temple in Phoenix has been hit harder than the general population of the city. And or if you look at Michigan, where you had a big outbreak at the time. So that's less of a Jewish story. But there is a Jewish story, first of all, of the financial damage that this has caused to institutions in the community that rely on donations. How Jewish schools have been dealing with this reality. We had one story, I think, back in March about the schools that transitioned to distance learning. And I wrote about it, and I interviewed several school principals. And I asked them, do you think you will go back to normal in September? All of them were optimistic at the time. They said, yes, I think by September there will be some kind of a way to open the school normally. I think if I will call them again this week, they are not going to be as optimistic. I mean, right now it's a much more difficult debate about reopening the schools. And this raises a question of, are people going to continue to pay the tuition that these schools rely on when the kids are all at home? Very, very difficult issue. And the last thing I will say, at the end of the day, the Jewish community in America is built on the idea of people coming together for rituals, for events, for all kinds of other gatherings.
For daily prayers.
If you can't have that, how are you still a community? Now, in the beginning, everybody loved Zoom, right? In the first few months, everybody was happy with, oh my God, we can do event on Zoom.
Yeah.
You know, we did a baby naming for Galia, my daughter, through the synagogue in Alexandria, Virginia, that my wife was working at the time. And the rabbi organized a beautiful ceremony, and it was actually fun because we did it via Zoom, so we could have people from the synagogue join, but also our family and friends in Israel and other people from around the world, randomly friends here and there. So it was very exciting. But at some point, everybody has Zoom fatigue.
Right.
And how long can you continue in this twisted reality that everything is through a screen? 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, that was fun, that was okay. But now it's getting to a point where people are tired of it. And what can the communities do to keep them as members and to keep the financial support that they need? It's going to be a very difficult dilemma for a few more months now.
Homeschooling, I think they call it these days.
Yes.
So, Amir, before I let you go, I know you're in the newsroom today as part of your preparations for your new role at Haaretz. Can you tell us what you're going to be doing?
Yes, so I'm going to be the assignments editor for Haaretz.com, for our English edition, also a U.S. news editor, which means I will continue to cover events in the U.S. to some degree and work with our extremely talented and smart reporters, Daniel Ziri in New York, but also Judy Miles and Alison Kaplan Sommer here in Israel, and Chemi Shalev and Anshil Pfeffer.
Friends of the pod all.
Yeah, all of the great, great team that we have assembled here. And it's going to be a new challenge for me because I was used to being on the reporter's end of the of the system here, you know, writing my stories, sending them off and forgetting about them until they appear online. And now I'm going to be responsible for, you know, working with other reporters, getting their stories into the system and developing them and improving them. And I'm really happy and excited about starting this. And I hope to come back in a few months and talk about what I've learned.
Absolutely. Well, again, welcome back. Good luck in your new position. And thanks for joining us.
Toda rabba. Thank you.
Thank you, too, to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich, and to you, listener. We'll be back again next week. So until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.